Welcome to today's Innovative Ideas podcast. My name is Paul Howard, and I'm a senior fellow and director of the Manhattan Institute's Center for Medical Progress. Joining us today is Dr. Andrew von Eschenbach, former commissioner of the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, as well as director of the National Cancer Institute. Currently, Dr. von Eschenbach also serves as director of the Manhattan Institute's Project FDA. We're here to discuss his recent Wall Street Journal op-ed, Medical Innovation, How the U.S. Can Maintain Its Lead. Dr. von Eschenbach, thanks for joining us today.
It's great to be with you, Paul. Thank you for having me.
Dr. von Eschenbach, there's been a lot of feedback to the Wall Street Journal article, a tremendous amount of positive feedback, but also some criticism and concerns, frankly, from people who are both outside the industry and even some people who've worked in the industry. Their perspectives on the op-ed, I think that read closely, their criticisms are more caricatures than they are fair points, but I think there are nuggets of concern there. They're going to rise again and again as we discuss efforts to modernize the agency, reform the agency. One question that's come up frequently in the blogs that I've read is how you propose to measure efficacy. One comment I keep seeing again and again is that effectively you're saying, let's jettison the FDA's efficacy standards and just release things on the market and study them in the post-market through some kind of epidemiological process. I don't think that's what you're proposing at all. Could you talk about that a little bit and perhaps how the pathway you're proposing addresses some of the challenges and shortfalls of the current clinical trial testing system?
When we talk about the FDA of the 21st century, we're not jettisoning safety in the interest of efficacy. What we're doing is recognizing that the tools of modern science and technology are going to enable us to address both safety and effectiveness simultaneously. The problem we have, Paul, is that people have been looking at this from the past experience, where we brought drugs and devices to market, tested them in humans, and we really didn't know enough about the products to understand how effective they were going to be or how safe they were going to be, and we only learned that in retrospect after a clinical trial. Today, with the new modern tools of science and technology that we have at our disposal, we can know a lot more about the drug or the device long before it's ever used in a patient. We can understand the mechanism of action. We can understand the biology of a drug. And we can be predictive as to how effective it's going to be, and we can be predictive with regard to what are the risks. Now, we still have to test that, but at the same time, we know so much more that our risk of failure is going to be considerably less. Most of the time today, in the past, drugs failed in phase 3 randomized trials because we didn't know enough about them when we started using them in patients. In the future, we will use these clinical experiences to validate what we already have learned and what we already predicted in the preclinical study.
And so I think the example you use in the article is that of regenerative medicine. There are places where you have breakthrough, truly innovative therapies, and where you know, it's more the equivalent of it's 19, I forget when penicillin first came on the market, but I guess early 1940s, late 1930s. And then you had a patient who was in sepsis and was going to die, and you gave them penicillin, and they lived, and you didn't need a placebo-controlled trial to see that. Now, you're taking it a step further and looking at the science and say, we can predict the mechanism of action. We can study it in the body through new advanced diagnostic tools that are coming online, so that when we test them in a patient, we can simultaneously monitor safety, monitor efficacy, and see the result in a real powerful way that's not going to require parsing statistics to have to find the result and have to have confidence that what you're doing. And you can effectively do that in a proof-of-concept study.
Exactly correct. Let's take the area of regenerative medicine as an example that you raise. And specifically within regenerative medicine, let's look at the issue of using someone's own cells, mesenchymal stem cells, and using them as a therapy. As we study those cells, we learn and understand about their biology to determine not only how effective they're going to be, but we're also learning what their risks may be. So, for example, we understand how they're going to work long before we ever use them in a patient. So we go into this knowing much, much more in what we'll call phase one, or the traditional studies that are done to test safety. And then what we can do is allow those drugs or those cells or those devices to be used in a wide population of patients who desperately need them, But at the same time, when in doing that, we can have in place a system for post-market surveillance. Again, since we have such sophisticated tools of information technology today that we didn't have 10 and 15 years ago, today we can use the post-market as not only an area where we're delivering these drugs and these devices, but where we're also continuing to monitor their performance. And that gives us the additional safety net, if you will. And what we're looking at now is a new future where we can do this differently than we did in the past and not sacrifice safety, but get life-saving and life-enhancing interventions to patients much, much sooner.
Another concern I think has been raised, and this has been raised before about the FDA's current accelerated approval pathway, is that when companies do get are able to bring a product to market, typically after phase two or late phase two trials, for instance, for cancer drugs, they're then often required to do a follow-up trial, a confirmatory trial in the post-market environment. The complaint is industry companies have not fulfilled a number of those commitments, could be for a variety of reasons, both legitimate and perhaps some not so legitimate, and concerned the FDA doesn't have the power to require companies to complete those trials. How would you address that concern of the objection made, well, maybe this is a good idea in principle, but in fact, what's going to happen is we're going to put a lot of drugs out there. Maybe we're going to know that they work, but the confirmatory trials are not going to get done. How do you address that concern?
You're correct. And in the past, many of those confirmatory studies, which companies volunteered to do after their drug was approved, they didn't do. And that's a serious concern and problem. However, we've taken major steps now to correct that. The last time Congress authorized or reauthorized the Food and Drug Administration, it created REMS, or the risk evaluation and management strategies. And I think we can go one step further. And when we have a post-market surveillance process in place, like the Sentinel Initiative, which FDA is currently bringing to the forefront, we ought to make that a mandatory part of the approval of that drug or device for marketing, such that if the company does not adhere to those strict and rigid criteria for post-market surveillance, FDA has the authority to immediately withdraw the approval of that drug. And with the withdrawal of that approval, obviously goes the withdrawal for any reimbursement that might be associated with that medical product. Those two things would absolutely be major deterrents to anyone not adhering to the prescription of the law.
And I think, you know, you really got into this debate a little bit over the Avastin issue for metastatic breast cancer. You and I talked about a few weeks ago. And the concern from cancer patients was there are subpopulations that may be seeing a benefit from this drug, and we think it should remain available for this indication. One potential benefit I see of this approach for the products that go through it would be, even if there were subpopulations through a registry or careful post-market surveillance, you could build data faster and make the case that even if you might change the information that was going to patients or change the indication on the label, you could work faster to identify those subpopulations where there might be a benefit. Is that right?
That's absolutely correct. So if one thinks about a post-market surveillance process, all the information you're gathering up to the point where the FDA may make a decision that it has to change its approval, all that information is continuously informing you of both the benefits as well as any possible adverse outcomes. It's giving you that information much, much sooner, much, much quicker, so that you can make adjustments much earlier. But as you are going along in that process, you're constantly learning. So what you've put your finger on, Paul, is that this new system is not a reactive process. When bad things happen, then we have to react to them. This is much more a proactive process. This enables us to be constantly monitoring the performance of these products, constantly understanding under what circumstances they work even better than we predicted, so we can be improving them and improving their application to certain subsets of patients that we can identify who have characteristics that enable them to get a much better response. And we can also pick out patients who might be having a more greater risk of an adverse event. We've seen this work in many of the cancer circumstances and situations where clinical trials indicated a drug did not meet its clinical endpoints. But when we were able to really understand what was happening, we could see that there were subsets of patients that were getting a unique and even dramatic, almost miraculous benefit. And that information enabled us to be much wiser, much more rational about who should get a drug and who shouldn't get a drug. And that's what this new modern scheme of regulation ought to be able to provide, not just as the exception to the rule, but as the rule itself.
And then finally, I think one of the issues, or the biggest issue, at least perhaps concerns for companies out there, is when they're releasing products through this innovative pathway, will insurers recognize it and provide payment for products that go through this pathway? And also, what kind of liability tort protection might companies have if there's some feeling that they're not going through the quote-unquote full FDA approval process? Are they more vulnerable to litigation if they haven't gone through that process? So maybe you could walk us through some of the concerns, both about reimbursement and then perhaps about liability.
As far as reimbursement is concerned, clearly that's a decision that's made outside of the FDA's regulatory process. My personal belief is that the FDA ought to make its decisions based on what the science indicates as far as the effectiveness, the benefit, and the potential risks or side effects of a particular medical product may be. And the reimbursement issue should be addressed elsewhere. But once the FDA has applied that scientific rigor, once the FDA has gone through the process of understanding in a preclinical setting how this drug works, what its expected effect is going to be on the target, what its potential risks might be, all that scientific information and data provide not just a justification for using that drug, it also provides a foundation and a justification for reimbursing or paying for that drug. And as long as we continue to realize we have the post-market surveillance in place, then reimbursement is really going to be much more rational because we're going to be paying for things that work. Well, the way we are doing things today, the most expensive drug that Medicaid pays for is a drug that doesn't work or a drug that has unnecessary side effects. And this new system could significantly improve on certain outcome.
So I think one side effect of the FDA's accelerated approval process for cancer and for HIV drugs is you've seen an explosion of innovation, at least in the cancer space, for personalized medicines, as companies, both large and small, recognize that the advantages of getting faster approval through the accelerated approval process also encourage them to bring faster evidence on efficacy and safety to the table by targeting them at specific patient populations. For instance, the recent lung cancer drug, Xalkori from Pfizer, I think is targeted at the 5 or 10% of non-smoking patients with lung cancer who have a specific mutation that promotes cancer growth in their bodies. So I would think that this path, the path you're suggesting, would encourage for other indications that haven't seen as much personalized medicine developed. You know, if there's this window here, this pathway for companies to develop these truly innovative targeted products in other spaces, just to use an example, diabetes, obesity, perhaps heart disease, that this might encourage companies to focus on them when before, the only pathway they could take is through, you know, the large clinical trial process, extremely time-consuming and expensive, and it doesn't necessarily provide that kind of tailored information you want. Is that fair?
It makes the very important point, Paul, that one size does not fit all. If we, again, look at the past, we use the traditional phase one, phase two, phase three process to approve all drugs and all biologics and all medical devices. What we have learned is now with the new tools that are available to us, we can begin to appreciate concepts like personalized medicine, the idea that you just presented, in which we now know that certain drugs will work in certain patients for certain conditions. And we are able now to have the tools to be able to understand that, to be able to even predict that, ahead of time. And so we can begin to see the need for moving away from a one-size-fits-all to now a regulatory process that has different pathways for different opportunities and different unique circumstances. Where we have the biology, where we have the scientific understanding of mechanism of action, where we can predict what the impact of that drug is going to be on the disease itself and on the patient as a whole, then we can create a unique regulatory pathway or process for that particular drug. We've essentially tried to do that already with pathways like accelerated approval, which was created for the to respond to the challenge of AIDS 20 years ago, and for Fast Track, which was created to bring cancer drugs to patients in a much more efficient and more effective way. And now experience is telling us that we can begin to go even further in being able to approve drugs for subsets of patients. And when one thinks about the terrible impact on people's lives that diseases like Parkinson's and AIDS and Alzheimer's and others are having, and we're beginning to understand that not all patients with Parkinson's have the same exact disease, but there are subsets. We need a regulatory pathway that is rational, that is appropriate, a regulatory pathway that is not going to encumber progress, but is actually going to facilitate progress. We need a regulatory pathway that's as innovative in how we bring these products to patients as the innovation has occurred in the discovery and the development of those interventions in the first place.
So just to close, I think we're talking about a pathway that brings what's happening in basic science in the laboratory and the understanding of human biology much closer to how we're actually testing, evaluating, and then using new products, new medical devices, new drugs, from the laboratory to the lab bench or the bedside, as they like to say, and doing it in a very iterative way when information is flowing back and forth through all the sectors in a very rapid manner. Is that a good summation of the position?
That's absolutely correct. And it's the position that the FDA has taken as well. Commissioner Hamburg and others at the FDA have pointed out that science has rapidly changed and that the agency requires a very modern scientific infrastructure. And she has been promoting the regulatory science initiative as a way of bringing the FDA up to a level where it has the capabilities and the capacity to be able to render these scientific decisions about the performance of a drug or a biologic or a device. At the same time, in addition to improving the scientific infrastructure, the FDA also has to modify and modernize its regulatory processes. And what we were calling for in the op-ed in the Wall Street Journal was for the FDA to, and as we go through this process of reauthorization of the FDA, to really do a bottoms-up and top-down assessment of, do we have the right regulatory infrastructure to meet the opportunities and the challenges of the 21st century? Science and technology is exploding around the world, and we are in the midst of a biomedical revolution. And we need to have a regulatory pathway that is a bridge and not a barrier to bringing the fruits of all of that discovery and all of that development to people whose lives are desperately depending upon that.
That's a terrific conclusion. And Dr. von Eschenbach, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Paul. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I appreciate the Manhattan Institute's focus on what is a critically important problem for people today.
Thank you. We'll link to the article, and we'll look forward to having you again soon.
Thank you.